for listening to Speak Up.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We are in a very bad place. Earlier today, we called for developing countries not to accept a bad deal, to say no deal is better than a bad deal. What we have right now is a very, very bad deal.
The UN climate summit in Baku, Azerbaijan has ended. Climate justice activists and developing nations slammed the final finance deal, which they say benefits wealthy, polluting nations. We'll get an update from ActionAid's Brandon Wu and War on Wants' Asad Rehman, who both attended COP29. And we'll speak with someone who didn't, who was denied a visa. Armenian Arshak Makijan led global calls to boycott the summit.
Politicians from all around the world, human rights organizations, environmental NGOs, they are greenwashing genocide at COP29 in Baku. A genocide that was committed against indigenous Armenians in Artsakh just a year ago.
Then Trump nominates Project 2025 architect Russell Vogt to head the Office of Management and Budget. We'll look at ProPublica's investigation into Vogt's plans to fire thousands of civil servants and support deploying the military domestically, based on recordings they obtained of his private speeches at the Center for Renewing America.
We want the bureaucrats to be traumatically affected. We want, when they wake up in the morning, we want them to not want to go to work because they are so, they are increasingly viewed as the villains.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. The UN climate summit in Baku, Azerbaijan has ended, with wealthy, polluting nations pledging to pay a total of $300 billion a year to help developing nations cope with the climate crisis they themselves did not create. But the agreement was widely denounced by nations in the global south and by climate justice activists. India's chief negotiator, Chandni Reina, described the deal as nothing more than an optical illusion.
We are disappointed with the outcome, which clearly brings out the unwillingness of the developed country parties to fulfill their responsibilities. As we struggle to deal with climate change, the outcome proposed in the paper will further affect our ability to adapt to climate change, greatly impact our NDC ambitions and its implementation, and create further challenges to our resilience, and above all, will severely impact growth.
We'll have more on the UN climate summit after headlines. In Gaza, Israel's repeatedly attacked the Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia as Israel's siege on northern Gaza continues. One drone strike injured the hospital's director, Dr. Hossam Abu Safia, who's repeatedly risked his life to keep the hospital open. Last month, his 8-year-old son Ibrahim died in an Israeli attack. On Saturday, Dr. Safia spoke from a hospital gurney in intensive care after the attack.
They are targeting everyone. But by God, this will not stop us from completing our humanitarian role, and we will continue to provide this service at any cost to us. We are still calling upon the world and will keep calling to the hope that there are those with consciences. I was injured in my place of work, and this is an honor for me to be injured in this place, since my blood is not better or more valuable than the rest of the martyrs. But this will not stop us. And we will continue to provide humanitarian service in a place known to the world. And we will provide it, God willing, no matter what it takes, no matter how long it takes, no matter what, even if it costs our lives.
12 other healthcare workers were injured at Kamel Adwan Hospital in another Israeli attack on Friday. Israel also bombed a building in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza, where several families were staying. At least 9 people died, including children.
The world is unfair. We are being killed and they are not doing anything. There is no food, water, and there is a besiege. And they kill us and everyone is watching. We only have God. May their souls rest in peace. Ahmed, Musa, and all his friends. They were friends together when they were killed.
Heavy rains and flooding is leading to more misery in Gaza. A civil defense spokesperson said Sunday, quote, rainfall has caused severe damage to tents housing thousands of displaced people, with water flowing inside the tents and damaging luggage and mattresses, unquote. Meanwhile, Hamas has announced an Israeli airstrike killed a female Israeli hostage in northern Gaza and injured another. The Israeli military did not confirm or refute the claim. Israel is also continuing to bombard Lebanon. On Saturday, an Israeli airstrike in central Beirut killed at least 29 people and injured 67 others. Survivors said no warning was issued before the attack.
What can I tell you? We escaped from Beirut's southern suburbs, Dahia, and we said we'd take shelter in Beirut because it's safe. What happened in Dahia has happened to Beirut. At least in Dahia, there's warnings and people leave. In Beirut, it happens without warning. Crime after crime, children killed. It's enough what happened in Gaza and what's happening here and what happened in Dahia.
Hezbollah responded by firing about 250 projectiles into Israel. This all comes as new reports are circulating. The Israeli government has agreed in principle to a ceasefire in Lebanon. In other news from Lebanon, Human Rights Watch has accused Israel of committing an apparent war crime by killing 3 journalists and injuring 4 others last month. Human Rights Watch found Israel killed the Lebanese journalists using an airdrop bomb equipped with a U.S.-produced Joint Direct Attack Munition Guidance Kit and what the group said was, quote, most likely a deliberate attack, unquote. The Israeli Knesset unanimously voted to sanction the Haaretz newspaper, saying the paper's editorials, quote, have hurt the legitimacy of the state of Israel and its right to self-defense, unquote. Under the move, the government will stop advertising in the paper and cut off communications with it. Haaretz responded by saying the decision is, quote, another step in Netanyahu's journey to dismantle Israeli democracy, unquote. In other news related to Israel, authorities in the United Arab Emirates have arrested 3 people after the body of an Israeli rabbi, Zvi Kogan, was discovered Sunday, 3 days after he went missing. President-elect Donald Trump has picked Project 2025 co-author Russell Vogt to lead the White House Office of Management and Budget again. Vogt helped draft the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 blueprint to radically reshape federal agencies. During the campaign, Trump distanced himself from Project 2025, but he's now tapping its authors for key posts. Over the weekend, Trump announced a number of other cabinet and high-level positions, including the billionaire hedge fund manager Scott Bessent to be Treasury Secretary. Bessent once worked for George Soros, but has since embraced Trump's use of tariffs and push for deregulation. For Labor Secretary, Trump tapped Congressmember Lori Chavez Dreamer, one of the few Republican lawmakers to support the PRO Act, which would make it easier for workers to unionize. Trump has also named controversial far-right pundit Sebastian Gorka to become Senior National Security Council Director for Counterterrorism and Deputy Assistant to the President. It's a top post that doesn't require Senate confirmation. Gorka advised Trump in his first term, but was pushed out after The Forward revealed he once had ties to a Hungarian far-right Nazi-allied group and that he supported an anti-Semitic and racist paramilitary militia in Hungary while he served as a Hungarian politician. During an interview earlier this month on the Russian broadcaster RT, Gorka denied Palestine exists.
Why can't you talk about genocide in Gaza? And is that the same with all of the Trump?
Because there isn't any genocide in Gaza. A, there is no such thing as Palestine. Do you know what the etymology of the word Palestinian is? It was a name invented by the Roman Empire.
Yeah, the problem is, interlocutor, you know that is not shared by the rest of the world. The rest of the world disagrees with you, so you're going to be as ice. You're going to be a game.
I'm glad you talk for the rest of the world.
Trump has picked former Florida Congressmember Dr. Dave Wilden to be the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Wilden is a vaccine skeptic who supported the debunked theory linking vaccines to autism. For Surgeon General, Trump tapped Fox News contributor Dr. Jeanette Nishawat, who serves as one of the medical directors at CityMD, a chain of urgent care centers in New York. Trump picked another frequent Fox News commentator, Dr. Martin McCary, to head the Food and Drug Administration during the COVID pandemic. McCary was a vocal critic of vaccine mandates. In a surprise pick, Trump has also nominated Brooke Rollins to be Agriculture Secretary. She served in the first Trump administration and co-founded the America First Policy Institute. Trump's also named former NFL player and White House official Scott Turner to head HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. This all comes as ethics experts are raising alarms over Trump's refusal to reveal who's funding his transition operations. Trump has yet to sign an ethics agreement to begin the formal transition process, which has prevented the FBI from doing background checks on any of his nominees. In other Trump news, New York Judge Juan Merchan has indefinitely postponed sentencing the president-elect over his criminal hush money conviction. In May, a Manhattan jury found Trump guilty on all 34 felony charges of attempting to influence the 2016 presidential election by falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment. In Uruguay, the center-left opposition candidate Yamandú Orsi won a runoff presidential election Sunday, defeating Álvaro Delgado of the ruling center-right Partido Nacional. Orsi is a former mayor, history teacher with the Frente Amplio, or Broad Front Party. He spoke from Montevideo after his victory.
In Uruguay,
I am going to be the president who builds a more integrated society, a more integrated country, where, in addition, despite the differences, no one can ever be left behind from an economic, social, and also political point of view.
In news from Pakistan, authorities in Islamabad are fortifying the city as tens of thousands of protesters head toward the capital to demand freedom for ousted Prime Minister Imran Khan. Schools in Islamabad are closed. Social media apps are partially suspended. Heavily armed police have set up containers throughout the city. More than 4,000 Khan supporters have recently been arrested. Khan has been in prison since August 2023 on what are widely viewed as politically motivated charges. In the Philippines, Vice President Sara Duterte threatened to have Filipino President Ferdinand Marcos Jr., his wife, and the Filipino House Speaker assassinated if she is killed amidst an escalating public falling out between the country's rulers. Sara Duterte made these shocking comments during an official briefing that was live-streamed on Facebook in response to a viewer comment about her own safety.
I have talked to a person. I said, if I get killed, go kill Ferdinand Marcos Jr., First Lady Lisa Araneta, and Speaker Martin Romualdez. No joke, no joke. I said, do not stop until you kill them. And then he said yes.
President Marcos Jr.'s security has been increased as he vowed to take action following the threats. Sara Duterte is the daughter of President Marcos Jr.'s predecessor, Rodrigo Duterte, who last month admitted he led a death squad while he was the mayor of Davao, and who's being investigated by the International Criminal Court over his so-called war on drugs, which killed thousands of people. President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. is the son of the dictator Ferdinand Marcos, who ruled the Philippines from 1965 until 1986, when he was overthrown in a popular uprising. In South Korea, negotiations have begun to create a global treaty to dramatically reduce plastic pollution. On Saturday, about 1,500 people marched in Busan, carrying banners reading, "Cut plastic production and drastic plastic reduction now." And in Australia, police arrested some 170 people as activists and kayaks formed a blockade at sea to shut down maritime traffic to the port of Newcastle, one of the world's largest coal ports. Thousands took part in the climate action in the state of New South Wales. This is Peter Schofield, a doctor and activist with the group Rising Tide Australia.
We're here in Newcastle. We're a singularity, really. It's in a unique place, being the largest coal port in the world, exporting vast amounts of coal. If we can make a difference here, and if we can demonstrate our commitment as a community and as a government to influencing things such that, you know, we minimise that, that can have worldwide implications. And so, you know, what we do here is very, very important.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The UN climate summit in Baku, Azerbaijan, has ended, with wealthy, polluting nations pledging to pay a total of $300 billion a year to help developing nations cope with the climate crisis until 2035. Climate justice activists in Global South nations slammed the final finance deal. In a minute, we'll speak with Warren Wants Asad Rehman in London, just back from COP29 in Baku. But first, as Democracy Now! Broadcast from COP29 last week, I spoke Friday to Brandon Wu, the director of policy campaigns at ActionAid USA. I asked about his thoughts on the deal. At the time, it stood at $215 billion a year at that point, and it caused the talks to stall.
We are in a very bad place. Earlier today, we called for developing countries not to accept a bad deal, to say no deal is better than a bad deal. What we have right now is a very, very bad deal. Remember, our baseline, what we have right now, which is not working, it's not enough, is $100 billion a year. That pledge was made in 2009. So we're barely getting any increase at all. And what's actually worse is that it could include private investment, market rate loans. It's not an actual transfer of resources from rich to poor countries, which is what we need to solve this crisis.
Explain what private is. What does that mean?
So that is a very good question. You know, in theory, it means, oh, this country might have spent a little bit of money to enable private investment to flow into a country. And then they'll say, for every dollar of money we put in, we leverage $7 of private investment. Who is defining those leverage ratios? Like, there's very little evidence base for how we actually count this reliably. And private investment only flows to certain places where investors think they can make a profit, right? So many of the communities that are suffering worse from this crisis are not a place where anybody is going to make a profit, or at least not in this sense. And so they're not going to see any of that money. What we need and what developing countries have asked for is a core of money that is public grant-based money, and that is not here. We're not seeing any of that.
So you're from the United States, the most powerful country on Earth, the historically largest greenhouse gas emitter. No. What role has the U.S. played here?
The U.S. at every turn has undermined the climate regime from the beginning. So what we're seeing now is actually the end of a 10-year strategy to exit from our obligations to provide climate finance. The Paris Agreement itself was the end of the U.S. strategy to exit from having any obligations to reduce our own emissions. Remember, we moved from the Kyoto Protocol, which had binding obligations, to the Paris Agreement, which is 100% voluntary. It was the U.S. that was behind that. And now what we're seeing is in the U.N. Convention on Climate Change, there is a binding obligation for developed countries to provide finance. And again, that could mean mobilizing private investment. It doesn't actually mean moving public money from the global north to the global south. And so it's an exit, it's a great escape is what we're calling it, a great escape from their obligations to the rest of the world.
What would the U.S. taking the lead on true climate crisis reform look like?
So it would mean cutting our emissions at home. So implementing something that looks like a Green New Deal, for example, right? We can quibble about the exact policies and what that would look like, but a massive transformation, a just transition of our own economy towards a more sustainable economy. And we know that's not enough because the climate crisis is global. And so it also means providing massive amounts of climate finance to enable action in other parts of the world where we know it has to happen. We know all the poorest countries in the world have to transition their economies. And we also know they don't have the resources for it. And so a country like the United States, where we've built our economy on pollution, right? We've built our economy on greenhouse gas emissions. We owe climate finance or a climate debt to the rest of the world.
So we're talking about the Biden administration right now. That's who's represented. That's who is the climate envoy, John Podesta, and his delegation. What about President Trump, next president, past president, who pulled us out of the Paris Agreement and promises to do it again? What will that look like?
So that's our fight at home, right? That's our fight at home. And I think the thing that President Trump does is his extremism mobilizes people, right? We got a Green New Deal, a vision for a Green New Deal, because people realized we're in a really bad place here under the Trump administration. We need a radical vision for a better world, and we're going to create that vision, and we're going to fight for it. And so it's really unfortunate that we have to go back to that place, but that's where we are. And, you know, I hate to say it's an opportunity, because I know, you know, the Trump administration is going to cause untold damage at home and abroad. But at the same time, that is an opportunity for us to develop the radical vision that we need, because right now we're just rearranging the deck chairs.
That was Brandon Wu, Director of Policy and Campaigns at ActionAid USA, speaking Friday at the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. As talks at COP29 went into overtime on Saturday, frustrated representatives from poorer global South countries and small island nations walked out of a negotiating room, but said they remained committed to finding a fair deal. Ultimately, a $1.3 trillion climate finance deal was announced Sunday morning, $300 billion a year for 10 years. It was $50 billion more than when I talked to Brandon Wu on Friday. For more on the latest developments, we're joined by Asad Rehman, Executive Director of War on Want, lead spokesperson for the Climate Justice Coalition. It seemed like he was everywhere at these UN climate talks, but I guess not in the negotiating rooms. Asad, you're back in London. If you can start off by just unpacking what this amount of money means.
Well, first of all, let's just clarify, it's not $300 billion. Dollars a year. It's $300 billion by 2035. And so there's no clarity about how much money will be provided each and every year. I mean, it could be $100 billion every year and $300 billion in 2035. Secondly, we don't know how much of that is going to be in grant-based finance and how much is in either debt-creating loans or other financial instruments. And just to also put it into perspective, $300 billion, if you take into inflation, count inflation, by 2035, it will be worth about $175 billion. Currently, Africa, the continent of Africa, pays in unjust debt repayments about $170 billion. So not only is it a drop in the ocean compared to what is needed, but it is a figure that masks the lack of responsibility by developed countries to put up the finance, the necessary critical finance that is needed for developing countries to be able to deal with the crisis that they haven't caused.
Pick up on that last point, that they haven't caused, because so many these days, especially in the most polluting countries, look at the United States, where we have President Trump coming up again, say, why should we give charities to these poor countries? But explain why this is not charity, but debt.
So, if you take the carbon budgets, the amount of pollution you can put into the atmosphere before temperatures begin to rise, that is calculated. There's this much carbon budget for preventing, for example, a breach of the critical guardrail of 1.5 degrees, after which we begin to start to spiral out of control. At 2 degrees, it becomes very, very difficult for anybody to be able to adapt. At 3 degrees, really, the notion of society as we know it, as it's currently constructed, would be very hard to realise or recognise that that could function in the same way. We're currently heading towards that 3-degree target. Often we say that 1.5 degrees is on life support. 4/5 of the carbon budget for 1.5 has already been used, and that's been used over the last 150, 200 years, overwhelmingly by the rich developed countries in the global north, way more than they are entitled to. So most of the global north countries have consumed 3 times to 5 times more than it would be equitable. So if you shared the carbon budget equally amongst all countries, the global north has overconsumed what they've done. Therefore, they owe a debt to the global south. First, for overconsumption of that carbon budget, which is now denied to developing countries, so they're not able to use it to develop, but also the consequence of overconsuming, and of course, We see that on a daily basis with killer floods, droughts, famine, storms, devastating so many people's lives and livelihoods. That is quantified as a climate debt.
What happens now, Asad Rehman? How does this money, how is it transferred, however low it is?
Well, I mean, again, now there will be lots of ongoing fights and struggle about what that $300 billion actually constitutes. When we began COP29 in Baku, the presidency gaveled through another important motion, which was the creation of a global carbon market. Now, a global carbon market basically says, you know, you can buy permits to pollute. So rich countries don't have to cut their own emissions, but they could buy a permit which would reduce emissions in another place and they would, you know, carry on as business as usual. Now, clearly, there's no carbon budget for those permits to be able to work. But often rich developed countries say, well, that is climate finance. That is the flow of money. Now, in 20 years of different carbon markets operating, none of that money has actually flowed in the figures and in the way that is needed to developing countries. So now we're really going to get into the meat of it. What is this $300 billion? How much will be public finance? How much will be debt creating loans? How much is it going to be actually asking developing countries to contribute to themselves, for themselves? And of course, many of the developing countries are already being overwhelmed, not just by the climate crisis, but about ongoing issues of inequality and being trapped into unjust tax and trade and debt burdens.
Finally, Asad Rehman, next year, COP30 will be in Brazil, the first time next to the rainforest. The significance of this, what it means, and do you think, as all of the climate justice groups were saying on Friday, no deal is better than a bad deal?
Yes, the reason why we were saying no deal is better than a bad deal was because, you know, we wanted, if rather than a deal which was going to be deadly for people and planet, which was going to be insufficient, inadequate, and of course, in the words of many developing countries, was an insult and a joke, it would be better to delay that to Brazil so that we could actually continue to negotiate and work. As you know, for 2 weeks, rich developed countries didn't put a figure on the table until the final day. That meant there was very, very little opportunity to be able to interrogate that figure or to find out more detail. Now, with Brazil coming up, there is an opportunity, not only because of the presidency, which has said that it's committed to tackling climate, but that also we as civil society, you know, have social movements in Brazil. And of course, we're able to exert pressure both on the outside and on the inside. And there are some fundamental big debates going to take place over this year, which will shape that. What happens with the UN tax convention? Will rich countries continue to block that, which is the opportunity to tax corporations fairly in the places they do business and do damage? Will there be a global wealth tax so that the richest 1%, who are responsible for about 16% of global emissions and seize most of the world's wealth, actually pay fairly? Those are places where new money can be made available. Will we shift away from the subsidies and handouts to fossil fuel and industrial agribusiness? That will liberate money. But there's also a very big debate going to take place in Brazil, which will be around the just transition. That's a vision of what comes next in the world. Will it be fair? Will we be able to guarantee people's lives and livelihoods through things like public services, making food and energy available to everybody? Will we reform our global financial architecture? All of that will be on the table in Brazil. And we hope that that is an opportunity, through building our power at both national and global level, that we can move the dial towards an outcome which actually is in the interests of people.
Baku to the future. Asad Rehman, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Executive Director of War on Want, lead spokesperson for the Climate Justice Coalition, today speaking to us from London, last week from Baku. The UN Climate Summit has ended, but of course, we will continue to cover all of these climate issues. Next up, we'll speak with someone who, unlike Asad, was denied a visa, could not attend the UN climate talks in Baku. Armenian Arshak Makijan led global calls to boycott the talks. Stay with us.
Freedom. My people of the world, come let failing to act. They cannot fulfill a promise. As the years go by, people and they die. It's a call for